This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading from the June 2026 issue of Arizona Highways. Kathy Montgomery is the author of Sororal Theater. Like wall calendars and fax machines, the Sororal Theater, against all odds, is still around, having survived the introduction of television, multiplexes, and streaming services. Recently, it changed hands, but the new owner is committed to keeping it a place where patrons can enjoy first-run movies with the latest technology. When it opened in 1948, the Sororal Theater was big news in Wickenburg. Under a banner headline, the Wickenburg Sun trumpeted the theater's Western vibe with its peeled logs, flagstone fireplace, and enormous Sororal towering above the neon-lighted marquee. The giant cactus being its dominant feature, you might think the name suggested it itself as plainly as a nose on your face. Yet in a naming contest, Wickenburg residents offered countless other suggestions. Wickenburg High School sophomore Douglas McPherson was one of 30 who suggested Sororal, winning the $25 prize on the strength of his letter. What could be more apropos than the name Sororal, he asked. Just look at the picture which was printed in the Sun. Like the College Theater, now the Valley Art, which had opened in Tempe 8 years earlier, the Sororal was a partnership between Harry L. Nace and Dwight Red Harkins. While it operated as part of the Harry L. Nace Theaters chain, Harkins got credit for the design, which replicated the College Theater's floor plan. The Arizona Republic declared the Sororal one of the most modern and picturesque theaters to be found anywhere in a Western community, adding that it was acoustically designed for talking pictures. Every story noted its innovative smoking bar equipped with speakers where patrons could enjoy a cigarette behind a glass panel and miss neither sight nor sound. And in the similarly equipped crying room, moms could console caterwauling kids. The smoking and crying rooms now serve as storage areas, and the original ultra-modern seats have been replaced many times over. But the theater's namesake cactus remains, and so does the single-screen auditorium. While most theaters of its kind have gone the way of the 8-track, the Sororal has survived the introduction of television, multiplexes, and the transition to digital. It's still a place where patrons enjoy first-run movies with the latest technology, but at yesterday's prices. And on Tuesday nights, they can step back in time to watch a film from a bygone era in a classic setting. The first memory I have of getting to go to the theater was when Queen Elizabeth was coronated, former Wickenburg Vice Mayor Royce Cardinal recalls. Tom Murphy and his wife, Shirley, operated the theater. Shirley walked around with a flashlight and whacked your ankle if your feet were on the seat in front of you. Molly Murphy Atwood says her mother was fearless when it came to rule breakers. You just didn't mess with her. When Wickenburg was still the dude ranch capital, Shirley had no problem breaking up fights that occasionally broke out between cowboys. She didn't put up with that rowdiness, Molly says, and would get in the middle of them and tell them to straighten up and head on down the road. For decades, the theater was a family affair. Molly began selling tickets and popcorn at age 14. Her brothers both worked as projectionists. My grandmother even worked for the theater for a while, she says. When Brian Devaney bought the business in 1995, his then-wife Beth recalls, the first improvement he made was adding doors to replace the curtains separating the lobby from the auditorium. Before that, you could hear traffic during the movie, she says, and you could sometimes hear cows mooing. The sound system, meanwhile, picked up ham radio conversations from a nearby trailer park. Brian had to beg this guy not to speak during these hours, Beth says. The theater did go dark for brief periods. The first was in the 1960s amid declining attendance that was blamed on television. It was in danger of closing again when films went digital in 2014, but the community rallied to raise money for a comparable projector. Former manager Ben Poley recalls that Vale Kilmer's mother, Wickenburg resident Gladys Leach, made a sizable donation. And when theaters had to close during the COVID-19 pandemic, restaurateur Jim Swift stepped in. He bought everything so we could keep it as a theater and it wouldn't close down, Poley says, adding that the previous owners had done a lot of remodeling, and when Jim came in, he took that and multiplied it by 10. Swift's upgrades included a state-of-the-art laser projector and more comfortable seating. When Swift sold the theater in 2025, he accepted Patty Sickles' offer from among competing bids because the longtime resident and business owner planned to run it as a theater. With a nod to the sorority's roots, Sickles plans to open an ice cream shop in the small adjoining office space that originally housed the theater's concessions. Molly says it swells her heart that people have worked to preserve both the landmark and its spirit, keeping it a place where imagination mingles with the scent of buttered popcorn and families enjoy a brief distraction from whatever is going on in their lives and in the world. The Sorrel Theater is located at 176 East Wickenburg Way in Wickenburg. Phone number 928-684-7189. Website sororaltheater.com. And this concludes Sorrel Theater. Gurinder Singh is the author of This Is My Story. As I hit the trailhead this morning, my step was a little quicker. Somewhere up the trail, a bird called once, then went quiet, as if surprised by the morning as well. Fog doesn't belong in the desert, which is why this morning felt like a secret, especially with no other cars at the trailhead. I had been in this canyon many times over the years, with the usual clarity, hard outlines, and piercing light during winter sunrises. Today, though, the canyon had softened. A thick fog drifted low across the landscape, curling through the sororals like something alive, curious, and flowing. As I walked around the sororals, tall forms appeared and disappeared, looking more stately than usual, their silhouettes blurred just enough to feel mythical, like guardians from an older story. I paused beside one sororal I'd passed 100 times without thinking. In the fog, it felt newly introduced. Moisture clung to its spines, tiny beads catching what little pre-dawn light filtered through the gray. The sun rose behind a thick bank of fog, turning everything silver. In the warming sun, the fog moved quicker as I darted through the canyon, trying my best to catch moments of the desert returning to focus. Meanwhile, as the fog came and went, the sororals remained rooted in a rhythm far slower than mine, their permanence contrasting with the swirling, ephemeral flow of silver fog around me. When the fog finally lifted, the desert snapped back into focus, sharp and familiar, as if nothing unusual had happened. But I knew better as I walked home, carrying the still of that morning with me. In a place defined by openness and light, the fog had briefly instilled mystery and softness, and the desert had whispered instead of spoken. And this concludes This Is My Story. Emily Rebeck is the author of 303 B&B Flagstaff. When Kim Davis and Don Woody Wooden discovered a yellow house on Juniper Avenue that was listed for sale, they saw its potential to be a picturesque small-scale bed and breakfast. After undergoing an extensive renovation in 2021, that house was transformed into 303 B&B Flagstaff, a modernized boutique inn featuring 5 rooms, each decorated in a curated color scheme along with individual bathrooms, a game room, and a gym. Davis and Wooden already had backgrounds in hospitality. Davis was raised on a dude ranch outside of Santa Fe, New Mexico, and the couple had run a 19-room B&B in Colorado. Their main goal with the Flagstaff property was to ensure their guests experienced the personalized warmth of a traditional B&B, but with the amenities of a luxury resort. Davis says achieving this balance lies in the details: coffee pots and plush bathrobes in each room, toiletries stocked in every bathroom, and even holiday touches along home-cooked breakfasts, from black-eyed peas at New Year's to cut-out strawberry hearts on Valentine's Day. I decorate for every holiday, and I do themed breakfast, Davis says. Guests look forward to having that, and every time guests come back, I always try to serve them something different. In the winter, those guests enjoy being just 30 minutes from Arizona Snowball. In the summer, the B&B becomes a hub for hiking nearby Walnut Canyon, visiting the Grand Canyon, exploring downtown, or just unwinding on the front porch. We looked at locations for our B&B downtown, but the reason we chose not to be there is because we get 100 trains passing through a day in Flagstaff, Davis says. Guests like it here because they can still get downtown easily, but we're tucked away and it's quiet. They love to sit on our porch where we have swings, tables, and a view of the mountain. Davis and Wooden want their guests to feel that 303 B&B Flagstaff is an extension of home. That's why, Davis says, guests who return have become more like friends than customers. People booking their stays knowing they'll experience authentic hospitality and a welcoming community. The best part of the business is getting to see repeat guests and getting to know them, she says. It's something I look forward to, and I know they look forward to. 303 B&B Flagstaff is located at 303 West Juniper Avenue in Flagstaff, phone number 928-727-2024, website 303bnbflagstaff.com. And this concludes 303 B&B Flagstaff. The next article is entitled, Take a Walk on the Wild Side, an essay by Nicole Walker. Every day in the United States, a million animals are killed by motor vehicles. It's a crisis that's threatening the survival of several endangered or threatened species, such as tortoises and bighorn sheep. To reduce the numbers, wildlife bridges are being built around the country. We have several in Arizona, including the Willard Springs Wildlife Overpass south of Flagstaff. Over a summer, I watched three spotted deer fawns wander my backyard in Flagstaff. Our homeowners association outlaws fences in part so the deer can pass safely from house to house. Still, we have roads that bisect the neighborhood as uniformly as fences do. It's not uncommon to see a herd of deer standing on one side with the other half standing across as they wait for the cars to pass. Mostly, the deer are patient and the drivers move slowly, except when they don't. As I drive down Fox Hill Road to pick up my son from basketball practice, a blue Audi is parked to the left. It has its hazard lights on. I slow enough to see a man lift a fawn by its legs, its entrails dragging across the asphalt, and put it to the side where there's some dirt to absorb the remaining blood. The deer's coat matches the sandy soil. The dots on the fawn's belly match the white concrete gutter. I drive forward. The Audi files suit. I try to keep it together. I have to pick up my son. I don't want him to see my face, a red mess of tears. If it hadn't happened right in front of me, I probably wouldn't be so upset. If I'd seen the fawn on the side of the road already dead, as I see Abert's squirrels, elk, coyotes, skunks, cats, adult deer, and ravens, I would have nodded at the twist of fur and bone and shaken my head, thinking, what a shame. Sometimes I'm glad I live in Flagstaff, where we have enough scavengers, such as ravens and vultures, to keep me from having to see the result of car and flesh collisions as often as I see it in other more populated places I have lived, such as Salt Lake City and Portland. But vehicles strike and kill animals all over the world, not just in the American West. According to the Federal Highway Administration, 365 million animals are killed by motor vehicles in the U.S. each year, a million animals a day. Globally, it's estimated that more than 5.5 million vertebrates are killed daily on roads, which adds up to more than 2 billion annually. These incidents threaten the survival of several endangered or threatened species, including tortoises, salamanders, ocelots, foxes, bighorn sheep, and red wolves. I drive from Flagstaff to Tucson to visit my daughter, who attends the University of Arizona. On the way down, I pass what might have been an American badger. It's biggish and dark-furred, but I can't really tell. Maybe it was a raccoon. A mule deer to the left looks like its neck has been broken. Luckily, I don't see an elk carcass because that ends up being a death sentence for elk, car, and sometimes human. By the Sedona exit, a grayish mound that may have been a gray fox, then one coyote, then two, then three. I try to reanimate them in my mind. I plead with them to think before they jump. Perhaps they can find what they're looking for west of Interstate 17. I argue with them in my mind. Stay to the west, I plead. When I arrive in Phoenix, blissfully, here are no dead creatures on the road. It's not until after Casa Grande that the animals return. Roadrunner, fox, javelina, coyote, 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 coyotes, all the way down. The effect on animals is not only the evidence we see on the side of the road. Roads divide and conquer entire populations. Animals cross roads for lots of reasons. Migration, territorial disputes, food, water, mating. Instinct, habit, and need force these animals to step from dirt and grass onto tarmac to complete their travels if a car doesn't hit them first. But some animals are shy about crossing roads, which is good for their immediate existence, but not so great for their species. The Arizona Game and Fish Department has spent the past couple of decades researching how roads divide groups of animals and curtail their movement. The lion's share of those studies are funded by the Arizona Department of Transportation and focus on reducing wildlife vehicle collisions and connecting habitat, says Chad Loberger, a game and fish research biologist. To that end, we have done a few studies that focus on pronghorn antelope. At first, the researchers looked at U.S. Route 89, a relatively new roadway with relatively low traffic volume, to see how pronghorns interacted with the roadway. Pronghorns are hesitant to cross them, and fencing hampers and prevents pronghorn movements, Loberger says. We discovered that, from a meta-population aspect, some herds might be becoming more isolated. This fracturing of pronghorn groups leads, over time, to inbreeding and reduced genetic variation. Jeff Gagnon, who works with Loberger, earned his bachelor's and master's degree in wildlife management from Northern Arizona University. At Game and Fish, he interned with Norris Dodd, who brought him into a project along State Route 260, the first major wildlife highway project led by the department. After Dodd retired in 2008, Gagnon took over the department's connectivity group with a focus on wildlife corridors. As population centers in Arizona grow, the researchers are leading the way to understanding and preventing collisions between wildlife and vehicles. It's an effort that builds on work done on Arizona's stretch of U.S. Route 93 to support the state's bighorn sheep population, which had fallen to dangerously low numbers before restoration efforts began in the 1960s. After three wildlife overpasses were constructed on U.S. 93, vehicle collisions with sheep dropped from 12 per year to fewer than one per year. The department's most recent project is the Willard Springs Wildlife Overpass south of Flagstaff. Construction of this wildlife crossing over I-10 continues. Recently, 26 large girders were installed and specially designed wildlife fencing is now being added. Loberger says the site was selected based on a number of variables, but mainly as a result of research that was conducted at that location for more than 20 years. In addition, the U.S. Forest Service owned the land. Topography was appropriate for an overpass, and an existing road cut made the location cost-effective. I like to imagine opening day for the animals, but it'll take a while to encourage them to cross. Fencing that directs wildlife toward the bridge will help, as will planting appropriate vegetation that serves as an inducement. In some cases, wildlife will start crossing even before the project is officially complete, Gagnon says. The fencing is key, though, to help animals first find the crossings. Ultimately, habits seem to be passed down through generations. We find that species have a learning curve. For elk, it's roughly 4 years. However, in the case of I-17, there is a possibility it could be learned quicker since the highway is such a barrier. Coyotes, foxes, and bobcats, he says, will be funneled toward nearby large culverts beneath the road. Those smaller animals will also use the overpass, Loberger adds. Once this fencing is installed, I-17 will have wildlife fencing from Woods Canyon to Kelly Canyon, and that is good for motorists and wildlife when combined with wildlife crossings and culverts. Animals live everywhere, but they don't stay in one place. Nature is neither zoo nor chaos. Animals are habitual, and they thrive where they live because their environment produces what they need, even if they have to travel a bit to get it. Some animals, such as bears, wildebeest, elephants, and bison, create pathways called sentry trails, which are used generation after generation to reach nesting grounds, food or water sources, or safe hiding places. Humans, though, build roads that bisect these trails, and studies have shown that animal species, particularly at-risk ones, would decline without policies limiting road construction. Where roads already exist, communities across the globe are trying to find ways to protect both animals and vehicles by building wildlife bridges and culverts that allow animals to safely cross. The first overland wildlife bridge was constructed in France in the 1950s, and the concept spread to other countries, including eventually the U.S. The first wildlife bridge here was built over Interstate 15 near Beaver, Utah in 1975. As I drive through Beaver to visit my mom in Salt Lake City, I scan the horizon for pronghorns, deer, and coyotes. I don't see any animals frolicking through the pinon pines and junipers. I also don't see any dead ones on the side of the road. On YouTube, Gagnon posts video of wildlife bridges across the state. I watch a recording from June 2, 2012, which shows a desert bighorn ewe and her lamb using one of the three overpasses to cross U.S. 93. They walk calmly as a river of traffic flows beneath them. In just 1 year, more than 500 bighorns crossed over those overpasses. With the new I-17 bridge crossing one of the busiest highways in Arizona, imagine how much more wildlife will be safe. The best thing about driving from Flagstaff to Tucson is getting out of the car. The traffic on I-17 and Interstate 10 becomes more tangled every year, and I don't like to count the coyotes I see on the side of the road. Sometimes when I see a brown thing littering the shoulder, I've already started mourning when I realize it's a cardboard box. It takes a moment for my emotions to untangle. I wonder if we see roadkill so often that we've come to see each animal as just another heap of garbage. When I arrive in Tucson, I abandon my car for a hike in Ventana Canyon, a bighorn sheep protection area. I hike and see no bighorns, although I have seen javelinas there. There are, I'm reminded, still safe places for animals. The Ventana Canyon Trail steepens. I turn back and let the hardier bighorns have the elevation. Gagnon says it surprises him how quickly animals often learn to use a wildlife bridge. I hope the researchers set up a camera at the Willard Springs Wildlife Overpass so we can watch the wildlife the way some of us watch Jackie and Shadow, the pair of eagles who nest at Big Bear Lake in California. What a gift it would be to see animals fully animated, pronghorns pronging, desert tortoises reaching their stout legs forward with ambition, bears lumbering, cougars soft pedaling, ferrets sidewinding, and elk ambling with fear of neither truck nor car. And this concludes Take a Walk on the Wild Side. Next up, letters to the editor that appeared in the June 2026 issue. Thank you for celebrating Mexican heritage in Arizona in your April 2026 issue. Your thoughtful articles are a significant countermeasure to the hate and falsehoods being spread by some voices currently in power. We need the reminder that Arizona and the United States is a result of a complex and multicultural history. Thank you for your dedication. Submitted by Hannah Connor of Phoenix. Your wonderful issue, Celebrating Mexican Heritage in Arizona, April 2026, prompted me to write to say how much I love receiving your magazine. I have taken it for many years. Each month it is like a special gift, full of beauty, interesting articles, and uplifting thoughts. I have lived my life in Florida, but I am the daughter of two Westerners from Colorado, my mother from La Junta and father from Cannon City, and grew up hearing about the wonders of the West. I visited Arizona on many occasions, have become enwrapped in your history, your archaeological wonders, and the amazing contributions to our nation from your Navajo, Apache, Hopi, and other tribes. I just want to let you know that your influence reaches far beyond Arizona's border and into the panhandle of Florida. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Submitted by Marjorie Turnbull of Tallahassee, Florida. Your April 2026 article on Derek Von Bryson, the Journal of Photography, brought back some fond memories of a wonderful gentleman. Several years ago, I decided to renovate my master bathroom. You ran a Von Bryson photo that became my focal point for colors in nature. After the job was completed, I contacted Derek and asked for a copy. He met me for an enjoyable lunch in Sedona and gave me a copy printed on metal so the humidity would not affect it. The picture is still on the wall and I enjoy it every day. Thanks, Derek. Submitted by Roger Warren of Chandler, Arizona. I had just finished reading Amy S. Martin's essay, Listening to the Land, Reflections on the North Rim, about the Dragon Bravo fire. Then I turned the page to find Noah Austin's scenic drive through historic El Capitan Pass, south of Globe, Arizona. Since 2000, my brother Greg and I have owned 20 acres at 5,000 feet just west of State Route 77 in the pass. In June 2021, the 180,000-acre Telegraph Fire traveled more than 60 miles and incinerated our beautiful High Chaparral property at the southern base of the Pinal Mountains. A week after the embers cooled, the Gila County Sheriff allowed us to walk our property. It was like a moonscape of gray ash. We were heartbroken. But as Miss Martin so eloquently stated, we soon saw positives from Mother Nature's cycle of fire. our vistas had opened up to more than 80 miles. The mosaic fire pattern had spared oaks, manzanitas, and junipers. The next spring, our rolling terrain was a riot of color from pink penstemons and orange globe mallows. By 2025, a desert wallow in our main wash was 20 feet tall. Greg's trail camera had recorded deer, badgers, foxes, bobcats, javelinas, rabbits, and coyotes. As Miss Martin stated, burnt soil is reclaimed, the landscape changes, but it still holds the magic. Submitted by Michael Ostapuk of Mesa, Arizona. Your focus on Arizona history, February 2026, was a great idea because Arizona has a very rich past. I was born in 1950 and raised in Arizona. I've had a lifetime of exposure to Arizona highways, and for the many years that I lived next door in New Mexico, the magazine has kept me well connected to my old homeland. This issue triggered a lot of personal memories for me. It was like going into a time machine. As I started to review this issue, I came to the article on the McLaughlin's early photography. Two can play at this game. On pages 32 and 33 is a photograph of Prescott's 4th of July parade in 1963. It's an old photo that I have seen many times in the past, and it has a very personal meaning for me. In the balcony of the Palace Bar, under the A1 beer sign, you will see my father in the cowboy hat, my mother, me, and two of my three brothers. Our fourth brother was riding his horse in the parade. Submitted by Steve Carson of El Rancho, New Mexico. That concludes today's readings from Arizona Highways. Did you know that if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org? Log on to sunsounds.org, left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on Demand Podcasts. In addition, you can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device. This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.